You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the latest Times Higher Education Books podcast. I'm delighted to say that my guest in the studio today is Svetlana Stevenson, reader in sociology at London Metropolitan University. And she's also the author of our book of the week, Gangs of Russia, From the Streets to the Corridors of Power. Svetlana, thank you very much for joining me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I suppose one of the first questions people will ask a Russian-born sociologist when they meet her in the UK is, how long have you been in Britain? How did you come to this country?
Well, I've been here now for almost 20 years. I came here, I got a Leverhulme Fellowship, and I worked at the University of Essex. And after that, I had a succession of research jobs and was lucky enough to get a full-time position at North London University, which is now called London Metropolitan. So I have become a teacher, a lecturer, but I also do research.
Now, I believe that the first time you came to the UK was at a summer school at the University of Kent in 1990 for Russian sociology students.
Yes, this was a wonderful program organized by Theodor Shanin, a British sociologist. And it was designed to introduce then Soviet sociologists to Western sociology and to colleagues here. So there were, I think, about 20 of us from all over the Soviet Union, and we spent a wonderful summer in the University of Kent. We thought we were in paradise. You know, these were unforgettable memories because we came from cold and hungry Moscow or the Soviet Union, where there was absolutely no food at the time. There was a crisis, you know, and life was very difficult. And suddenly we come to Canterbury and we had this, I think, a sort of perhaps false impression of England, just being like Canterbury.
Yes.
You know, but people were extremely welcoming, and we had very good lecturers, I think the best sociologists from the UK. And yes, we fell in love with this country.
It sounds like a wonderful opportunity.
Yes.
For presumably when you became an academic, as a young academic, you didn't expect that you would ever be outside the Soviet Union.
Well, absolutely. I never expected to travel. And I always loved languages. But when I was learning English, you know, we had textbooks which were not about the English society, but they were about Russian students studying in the library. Like Comrade Petrov says to Comrade Ivanov, are you going to the library today? Because there was no expectation of us ever coming to the country. And, you know, many people didn't think actually that languages were of any use. But I just liked like to read, and so my English was more or less okay. But I remember coming to this country, and I couldn't ask for food in restaurants because we simply didn't learn these words. It was all about, you know, work and books and so on and so forth. So this was, you know, a revolutionary change in my life, I would say, and in most people in the Soviet Union's lives, when suddenly the borders were open, and you know the world became it just became real. it had been unreal before that. We could only see something on TV, which was completely, you know, I guess distorted, you know, and bits and bobs.
This act of scholarly generosity in bringing Soviet scholars to the UK at that time must have had a huge impact on all of you personally. You must see that now when their efforts to bring refugee scholars from other countries or to support exchanges. You must really see the value of it.
Well, absolutely. This was fantastic. The fact that we were welcomed and, you know, we were seen as colleagues, you know, not some sort of supplicants, you know, and there was a kind of a very collegial atmosphere in the summer school, and this was an amazing window into the Western sociology, and yes, I think this was absolutely marvelous what was done for us.
Now, your husband is from the UK, and you met and later married in Moscow, is that right?
Yes. He came to Moscow. There was a British government program at the time called the Know-How Fund. So he came for a month to help the Russian government to develop its employment service, and stayed for 5 years. And yes, that's where we met.
And so you were married in 1995, and then after that time you came to the UK and began your career as a scholar.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And you have a grown-up son, Alexei, who is a translator, is that correct?
That's right, yes. He's bilingual, so like me, likes languages, is much better than me, actually. So yes, he loves what he does. He mostly translates academic literature from Russian into English, but yeah.
And you mentioned to me that both your parents were historians.
Yes.
And they worked on the Great Soviet Encyclopedia.
Yes.
Were they... they were still alive when you moved to the UK?
No, sadly, they both died at the beginning of the 1990s.
Right. They would have been delighted to know of this opportunity, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they would be, and... my mother was still alive when I went to the summer school, so she was extremely happy for me. Yes, I think they would have loved me being able to do research and being a part of the international community of scholars.
And your first degree was in history, but you mentioned that your interest in sociology perhaps began with a book that your father gave you access to, American Sociology, a textbook.
Yes, well that's right. Suddenly, I don't know why, but the Soviet publishing house decided to publish a translation of some of the key texts by American sociologists, and this was a rarity, but somehow my father got hold of it and gave it to me. And I was absolutely fascinated by it, and I thought I would love to do something like that. The opportunity did not present itself until Mikhail Gorbachev, who I'm immensely grateful to for a whole range of reasons, but, you know, he decided that the Soviet Union needed to study public opinion of its citizens, and he... founded this first ever All-Soviet Center for Public Opinion Research, our director was a famous Soviet sociologist, Tatiana Zaslavska, and there were some other very good people working there, and I was fortunate to get a job there, and so quite soon I started also to participate in research, and did my doctorate and became a sociologist.
So do I understand correctly that sociology as a discipline didn't really exist in the Soviet Union prior to that?
It did exist, but it wasn't even called sociology. It was called applied social research.
Right.
Because it wasn't... in a sense, the Communist Party... didn't think that sociology was a proper discipline. Of course, we had scientific communism as a kind of alternative. Sociology started to develop in the 1960s, And it was sort of quite positivistic. It was mostly about quantitative surveys, and there was an institute which is now called the Institute of Sociology. And there was one department of sociology at Moscow University. But otherwise, it was, you know, in a kind of embryonic state, I would say.
Right. What did your fellow students and academics at that time, what was their perspective as to how sociology, when you were studying at this institute, do you think anyone suspected that sociology might present a narrative that was counter to, you know, the by then still official view of how things should be? Presumably in a communist society, things were supposed to be pretty good, and therefore sociology might turn up some difficult points.
I think when I started working, this was already working and studying sociology, this was a time of Glasnost, and there was an enormous excitement about sociology and public opinion research, and we didn't feel constrained. Although there was one occasion when somebody called our director, Zaslavskaya, and said that Gorbachev wasn't happy with one of our surveys. We gave him a low popularity rating.
Oh, really?
But, you know, there was a great calamity at work, but nothing. There were no consequences at all at the end. When we started doing our public opinion research, I remember that sometimes people, just members of the public, would send us envelopes with some cash because they wanted to support us.
Oh, my God.
There was such an excitement.
So people were aware of your work?
People were aware of our work, and we were so, you know, enthusiastic. We thought that, you know, if we investigate public opinion and you know, open up this whole area of public discussion, you know, about society, then, you know, change, positive change would be inevitable. And we worked really hard, you know, and, you know, some people went without holidays or weekends because there was this, you know, there was this, I guess a lot of people at the time shared this kind of revolutionary excitement about change, which lasted for a while, I think for several years.
So do you think you would have been seen differently to, say, you mentioned to me in email conversations that, you know, when you were doing your undergraduate degree, some of the academics there in history were kind of unreformed Stalinists,
yes,
very much part of the party line. So does that mean members of the public during the time of Glasnost had a range of views of different kinds of academics, some of which were part of the old guard, and maybe some, like the sociologists, were more hopeful?
Probably. I think, sociology to an extent was quite new, especially this field of public opinion research. And people who founded our center were, well, if not dissident, but sort of known oppositional figures,
right,
like Tatiana Zaslavskaya, who had been known in the West for writing a famous letter where he to the Politburo, saying that the Soviet economy was doomed, you know, and was completely inefficient, and radical reforms were needed, and other people like Yuri Levada, who became later the director, who had been previously fired from the Institute of what became the Institute of Sociology, and he was one of the leaders of sort of informal kind of sociological circle, you know, which people who gathered, I think, in his flat and discussed sociology almost in a kind of underground way. So all these people started to work for this center. So they were very, very different from the academic establishment as I knew it when I studied myself, when I was a student.
So did you feel at any point when, obviously, when you had an opportunity to come to the West and, you know, with your husband being English and returning, what was your hopes for the discipline in Russia? Have you still any former colleagues there? Did you feel like you were leaving behind a project that was important to you?
Yes, I still have a lot of colleagues with whom I work on my research,
right.
And in many ways it was a shame to leave Russia because this was a place where I was and I'm still doing my investigations. And I still feel a part of the Russian society.
So collaboration with colleagues there is still ongoing.
Yes, this goes on, and I, even if I'm not doing research, I'm visiting, I'm going to conference, I'm doing some teaching. So I'm trying to stay as close to my colleagues there as possible.
Well, on the subject of research, let's talk mm-hmm. about the research that informed this book now. Looking at your research record, you have focused in the past on homeless people, on street children, sex workers, child laborers, sort of social exclusion generally. How did that kind of research first appeal to you? Obviously, out of all of the things that sociology could encompass, this is very much people either on the margins or perceived to be on the margins.
Yeah. Well, it started with a project, which was actually a joint project with a British academic, Greg Andrews, who had some money from the ESRC to study homelessness
right.
in Russia. And I did the field work. And in the course of this field work, I've realized that, you know, as often happens with interviews, that a lot of one's preconceptions are just wrong. You know, before I started this fieldwork, like many other people in Russia, I thought that, you know, if a person is homeless on the streets, there must be something not wrong, but, you know, some sort of some personal issues maybe,
right.
or, you know, kind of very special circumstances that led them to the streets. And when I started talking to these people, I realized that they were, you know, like anybody else. And in fact, I felt that, you know, if, you know, one or two misfortunes in life, and I could be there.
Right.
So I didn't feel there was any difference between me and them. And I also saw that, you know, they were not cut off from society. They had a lot of connections, like, you know, they had friends among the housed alcoholics, for example, with whom they exchanged various services, or some of them still had contacts with relatives and so on. So again, this was something, you know, we see this world is totally cut off, but it isn't. And also I was very interested in the social organization on the streets, you know, in people's own society, how society is possible somewhere where we don't believe it is possible.
Right.
So it was a very painful project for me, but also very very interesting, and I felt worth doing. And you know, we were in touch with Russian Ministry of Labor and Social Development, gave them a report, and I felt, you know, that maybe we can make some difference. And from then on, I studied similar groups, such as homeless children and sex workers, and again, I found that, you know, preconceptions that you carry into the field just disappear. So that's why it was interesting. And this work has led me to the interest in gangs, because when I was doing my research with this population, I realized that at least for some of young people, particularly young men, yes, who felt completely, you know, disorientated, and had this sense that, you know, they were not needed by anybody, there was this kind of vision of this brotherhood, that
a family
which, yes, it's criminal, but it's a place where you can find protection, where people would look after you, where you'd be able to earn money. And so they had this romantic vision of this sort of spiritual home, this criminal society, a gang, organized crime groups. So I thought I'd really would be very interested to study this.
And it wasn't easy to do. Is that there's not? It seemed from what you said in the book that there's not a huge literature base, and that there's something specific about Kazan in Tatarstan that made it easier, perhaps, to study. So
yes,
maybe you could talk about your choice of that city.
Yes, I guess there were two factors which sort of led me to choose Tatarstan. One was that there was a history of gang development there, which lasted back to the Soviet times.
Right.
Kazan gangs were famous even in the Soviet Union, because suddenly in the 1970s, 1980s, young people started to form gangs. Some of them were purely social, some of them were entrepreneurial. They were creating racketeering teams and demanded protection money from various representatives of the shadow economy, Soviet shadow economy. And then, of course, you know, when Perestroika happened, and then when market reforms came in, these gangs were at the forefront. So this was one of the factors. The second factor was that there was a team of people who had been studying this phenomenon again back in the Soviet times, and they continued to do this after the start of market reforms. So, and we seem to be of very similar, you know, coming from a similar methodological angle, qualitative research, and had very similar interests, because they were interested, like me, in what we call social capital and people's connections, networks, in how they use them to advance in life, even in this area of organized criminality. So we sort of found each other and decided to do a project together.
And Gangs of Russia is based on in-person interviews, sort of ethnographic work with young people. Now, these are all young men. It's a male world who are in gangs in Kazan. One of the things that astonished me about it was just how many people you spoke to. And I always assumed that if these gangs are criminal, they're operating outside the law, they're beating people up and threatening people, doing criminal things to get money. I was astounded that you could find so many young men to speak to. Maybe you could tell me, were you surprised that they wanted to talk to you about beating people up and other things?
Well, yes and no, because even in my previous research, when I talked to people involved in violence, especially young people, I realized to sort of fascination and horror that violence for them was something that they love talking about, because well, I guess if they grow up in environments where violence is present, and it's actually quite ritualized in Russia, in the sense that there are traditions of two villages meeting up, and these traditions were transposed into cities, so even now I found that in Moscow this goes on in the peripheral areas of these now global cities, where groups of young men would meet, you know, like in the medieval times on a bridge over a river, or in some areas, in sort of in some areas, neutral areas, you know, and fight to test each other's strength, and they have the regulations. They can't use weapons.
So they're not trying to kill each other.
They're not trying to kill each other. Well, in gangs, in criminal gangs, They actually also have the so-called wars, where they are not trying to kill each other, but they are fighting for territorial control.
Right.
So they are using surveillance in order to find where members from different gangs live, and they come to their houses, they beat them up, and every side counts their victories and their losses, and on the basis of that, the victory is given to one or the other side, and so it's still quite ritualized. But this is the situation now. In the 1990s, from what I gathered from my research and interviews, people would kill each other.
Right.
There was much more serious violence, because there was a process of vigorous redivision of cities, the city turf, because whoever had this piece of turf, whoever had control, could then demand the tribute from the local businesses, self-employed people, and so on. So this actually mattered a lot. By the 2000s and now 2010s, these wars have become much less frequent, and the city is divided.
These gangs are geographically centered in the main. Is that the case? Large housing estates, your street or your group of lads. They call themselves lads, don't they?
Yes. It's a term which describes a sort of a street young men, and some of them, some of those who are not involved in organized gangs, are called ordinary lads, and or normal lads, and those who are called real lads.
Right.
So there is this distinction. Yes, they call themselves lads.
And this rise in gang activity came in a power vacuum as the Soviet Union was collapsing. Is it essentially they became even law and order, or took over from the I mean, surely there must have still been police, even though the Soviet Union was changing.
Yeah.
Were they just much weaker, or did?
Yes, there was definitely a vacuum. Although the state was on the scene, it didn't disappear. But it first of all was much weaker, and second, some of the police themselves wanted to get income from racketeering.
Right.
So what my research showed was that there was a time where, let's say, there would be a company, and there would be groups of racketeers demanding tribute from the company managers. Some of them would be the police.
So protection money.
Protection money. Some of them would be police. Some of them would be the gangs. So they could operate in parallel to each other, or even create joint racketeering structures.
And so these local gangs seem to have a lot of organizational features that I guess a lot of people wouldn't know about. They have an obshak, a kitty that people, members have to pay money into. They're divided along age lines where you can move up as you get older. There's obligations you write about. You know, they're supposed to do sport to keep fit. They're sometimes not supposed to drink. They've got duties they have to do. They have meetings. They're supposed to avoid gratuitous violence. It sounds like a kind of violent entrepreneurial scouts.
Yes.
Were you surprised as you learned about all the things that were involved in being a gang member?
Yes, yes. This was absolutely fascinating. The cohort structure is quite common in youth gangs all over the world.
Right.
So when a young man joins a gang, he goes through stages as he ages.
The younger ones do the beating up, the older ones not so much, apparently.
Exactly, exactly. And in some ways, you know, there are similarities with some of the American gangs.
Right.
So it's not that unique, right. I think.
But the centralized funds, I thought, was interesting, a kind of community or almost cooperative financial structure.
Yes. This can also happen in America. There are some neighborhood gangs in America which have their own common fund and sort of some financial management. But
what do the Russian gangs use this money for? Where does it go to? The big boss of the gang, or
no? It's this common fund is spent partly to finance joint activities. For example, if the lads need a car to go somewhere, for example, to a showdown with another gang, the petrol is paid from the common fund.
Right.
Or members can get this money for investment, because many of them have their own projects.
Right.
You know, racketeering projects or, you know, drug selling projects and so on. So they can get money for investment but give it back, obviously. Or some of the money goes on bribing the police, right. Or paying for the lawyers. Some of the money goes on to surveillance. So it's in this sense, it's a business.
You mentioned the phrase violent entrepreneurs. Is this essentially just a business structure? Is that really what people get out of it?
It's violent entrepreneurs is a concept suggested by Russian sociologist Vadim Volkov, who wrote a book called Violent Entrepreneurs about organized crime in Russia in the 90s. I agree with him that their economic operations can be described as being violent entrepreneurship, because they use organized violence for economic profit. There are other functions of the gang which go beyond entrepreneurial activities, which are, I think, it's essentially a brotherhood.
You mentioned the phrase living with the lads.
Living with the lads, exactly.
Is very important. Maybe you could explain exactly what that means. They don't literally live with them, but you're supposed to spend time with your group.
Yes, it's a mobilized organization where people do not only make money together, but they're supposed to spend their leisure together. They're supposed to... and they do see each other as friends, as brothers. And in fact, when I talked to them, it became obvious that they spoke about their communication, being together, with joy. It was something, you know, they only felt themselves in the company of other gang members because they had complete understanding with them. It doesn't mean that they did not communicate with other people. You know, they had other friends, they had relatives, some of them had jobs, studied, but this was a kind of the privileged environment again. And that's how they said, some of them said, I joined the gang so that I could live with the lads. So he entered a family, in a sense.
And so it's a very homosocial environment, maybe not that different to football fandom or being in the army, or is this just another iteration of that kind of exclusively homosocial universe that we see in many places in the world?
Absolutely. It is homosocial. It's a space where men enjoy each other's company and all kinds of rituals, including violence. And it is an exclusive male space, although women do feature on the fringes of a gang, like, you know, girlfriends or wives, or even mothers. A mother is a kind of sacred figure, at least in the sort of mythology. But women are not allowed to be members. They are not allowed to be present at the gang's meetings. Only at the higher levels, if those gang members to graduate to positions in more serious organized crime, mm-hmm. there their wives can have a more serious role.
One of the things that I think will be very interesting to readers of this book is how much the term bespredel comes up, which you say means anarchy or lawlessness. Now, before I read this book, I would assume that that would be an extremely positive term to young men who want to go beat each other up. But in fact, they want to avoid it at all costs, apparently. It seems to be something that they say, no, that's bespredel.
Yes, this word was born in the Soviet prison society, and it means a lack of any regulation of violence. Now, the point is that organized criminals see themselves as a kind of elite, and even these young men on the streets see themselves as a kind of aristocracy.
They think they're better than the guys who aren't in gangs, who
exactly.
are weak and not very male, is that?
Exactly. And they have the law, which other people don't have. So this perception and the whole worldview implies that there are limits on violence, that they are not just criminals who would do anything, you know, for the money. So that's why the notion of bespredel is very important, and it was mentioned frequently in the interviews. Now, this doesn't mean that they don't do the things that they condemn. In fact, they do them, and they can beat up and, you know, even kill in certain situations, you know, people who are weaker, you know, or older people, whatever, you know, because, you know, violence, as we know, you can't really regulate it, you know, it overflows, you know, and in a situation of a fight, nobody knows what would happen. And also, of course, you know, if something is necessary for their business, you know, rules become quite flexible.
Right.
But for their, I think, perception of this of themselves as aristocracy, this is important.
Does that mean if they see themselves as aristocracy and they're the real men and their universe is the one that's most important, how do they then explain still having contact with their family, you know, a weak female figure or a father who might not be in a gang or other people? Why are they not? A lot of people assume that a gang must be totally apart from normal society, you know, sort of living in a bandit paradise. And yet many of the young men you speak to seem to be you mentioned that this double helix, where they're part of the gang world, but they're part of society, regular society as well.
Yes, this is absolutely right. They make their money by doing criminal things. Actually, not exclusively criminal things, because some of them invest their money into, let's say, buying a kiosk or hiring a trader in the street market, and so
which they're
on.
Not supposed to do themselves, but they can
exactly,
get someone to
yes,
do
yes, they
it.
Can get somebody to trade. But what I think is important to understand is that this is not a society which is totally separate. Some of the young men, particularly those who come from families, you know, with some criminal background, you know, who don't have education, they are cut off and they fit with a sort of a kind of stereotypical image of, you know, criminals making a criminal career. But many of the young men, at the time when I was doing my research in 2000s, saw opportunities elsewhere. So they would stay in the gang. They would get income, which was not, to be honest, huge from their gang activities, at least if they were at the lower ranks. But they would also study and or work. And in fact, they didn't see these two things as mutually exclusive, because they thought, and I think this is a kind of probably Russian thing, that all connections are good. That, you know people who may help you, let's say, if you need violent resource, you know, for example, if you have a business and you need to protect it,
Your friends in the gang
would be helpful, especially that when many of them come to eventually to work in private security companies.
Right.
And you will have friends and connections elsewhere, which would also be helpful. So some of the gang members were, you know, not only working and studying, but trying to develop political connections. Some of them would go to meetings of the United Russia division, in the local division in Kazan, and so on. So this is why I'm talking about this double helix of social mobility.
How do non-gang members see gangs? If they see themselves as the aristocracy and they want to avoid this anarchy or lawlessness, you know, we often hear that the mafia, for example, charge protection money, and I know that some of the Russian gangs do this as well. Does it work? Do people say, you know, there's always the stereotype about what EastEnders said about the Cray twins, or, you know, gangsters in the East End in London, that they maintained order. Of course, there's plenty of proof to show that people knew that they didn't. So do people say, well, at least we've got the gang members here, they're keeping everything in order?
I think there was an element of this. I think, generally speaking, people were not happy with the situation.
Oh, they didn't like the gangs.
No, they would have much preferred, you know, normal kind of legal order.
Rule of law, police force,
law.
And so on.
Yes, but this was unavailable. So the alternative of having, as we said, беспредел, unregulated violence, was also unpalatable. So gangs sort of, at least violence was sort of predictable.
Right.
And this, this doesn't. I wouldn't characterize the whole of the city in this way, you know. But in areas mostly in peripheral areas of the city where there would be high levels of crime, and where gangs were present, some of the local residents would say that, you know, at least the gangs do not like беспредел. at least, you know, if something happened, you may find contacts with them, and for example, the gangs could help investigate, you know, a burglary, you know, find somebody who stole a car, or it provides some redress. But it wasn't like Italian mafia, where you have a local mafiosi who everybody knows and who represents this alternative order. Right. Now, you needed to have some personal connections with a gangster for them to help you.
But overall, it doesn't sound like a great solution. You mentioned that the stories of the gang members in Kazan made it obvious that nobody felt safe.
Yes, exactly. It was a very violent reality. So, you know, gang members themselves had lots of stories where, you know, their girlfriends were assaulted, where there would be sudden fights on the streets, where, you know, they and their mates would be beaten by you know, other predators. So I wouldn't say, yes, that there was some kind of order, really, because there were all kinds of different violent actors who competed with each other and who were dangerous to each other.
It's a very male universe. You are an academic and a woman. Do you think that made it easier for you to speak to them, or harder, if they don't respect women very much or see them as not even at the level of men who are non-gang members? Did they?
I think sometimes it was hard, exactly because they do not see women as equal. But as an academic, I felt in a sort of privileged position because in Russia, there's still respect for academics.
Right.
Does
that go back to Soviet times?
I think it goes back to the Soviet times. And people sometimes think that, you know, academics would be able, well, to make life better by giving recommendations to the government and or maybe writing about social problems. And I did see this among my interviewees. I once interviewed a member of an organized crime group in Moscow who gave a tenth of his income to the Moscow Children's Hospital.
Really?
And he just, well, many of them do give money to the church, but he decided to give it to charity. And he wanted me to write about his experiences and also to encourage other people to give money to charity. So he was quite an amazing person. So there is also this sense, as I said, that they represent a kind of a better form of society than the disorganized, materialistic urban society, that they have their law, they have their sense of honor, and they were happy to talk about this as well.
So they felt that there were lessons for other people to learn from how the gangs see the world?
Yeah, they thought that, you know, the perceptions of justice, their sort of primitive democracy, their sense of brotherhood is something that other people should look up to.
And none of their experiences, none of the fact that what they're doing was illegal in many cases, did they see, therefore, the laws of the land and the justice system as being illegitimate?
I think it's interesting because some of them would say, you know, well, one guy said, well, I'm not very fond of the police, but they are necessary because without them there would be complete беспредел, complete lawlessness. So in a sense, they see a place, well, not all of them, obviously, but some of them see a place for the police as well. So they have a kind of grudging respect for some of the things that the police do. But they also, you know, basically, they see that there is a scope for them to make money, and that's what they are doing. But there are people who are dissatisfied with this life and are trying to leave the gang. And also saying that, you know, nowadays when the street economy doesn't give a lot of income, you know, it's much better to go and work in a proper company or for the government. So they're trying to move away. Sometimes without leaving the gang officially, because it is quite difficult. To leave a gang officially, they would have to give all the money back to this common fund and also go through a kind of ritualized beating, which can be quite severe. You can't just leave in it, it's not like a job, it's a brotherhood, so there must be rituals of exit, and they're quite hard. So what people do, they stay nominally in the gang, they still come to some of the meetings, they still socialize with their mates, but they move away in terms of their career aspirations.
One of the things that would be particularly interesting to readers, I think, is toward the end of the book, where you talk about the sort of gang flavor of public and business life, higher, more prominent people in society, in businesses or in government, tend to speak or act in ways that will resonate with people as being kind of gang language. Even Vladimir Putin, some of the things he says, one of your interviewees says Putin is a correct person, he gets respect. That sense, he talked in an early interview about how He wasn't a young pioneer, he was a hooligan. Does that mean people, at least in part, supporters of Putin look at him and think, yeah, I bet he'd be a lad, he wouldn't be one of the wimps sitting with his books being a biologist or a botanist, he'd be out there on the street? Is that...
Yes, that's absolutely so. Putin's self-presentation plays actually to quite a wide audience of people who may themselves have grown up on the streets, not necessarily being part of organized gangs, but know the culture. And he represents this tough masculinity and uses some of the slang, which is also used, you know, in the gang society. So I think this is partly, as he said himself, a result of his upbringing on the streets when he was a young man, and partly a deliberate performance where he tries to respond to the images of dominant masculinity, of people who would not let themselves be abused and who would respond violently to any provocation, and this is popular.
And most people must then read that for what is intended, even if you're not a gang member or you don't agree with it. Would a Russian look at that performance and say he's trying to appeal to people who think gangs are one way to be a real man?
I think I think. It's not so much about the necessity to be in gangs, but I would say it is this the fact that the system of the structure of feeling that we see on the streets or in gangs can be also seen at the highest level of the Russian society. So the need to protect one's turf, to respond violently to any provocation, this sort of worldview seems to be, you know, present from top to bottom. Of course, you know, there are other people who totally reject this kind of sentiments and feelings, and many people in the oppositional intelligentsia are very worried that the language of the street and of the gang has permeated the public pronouncements at the higher levels of the state. But so far we have seen that, you know, they're a minority.
Things appear to have changed for gangs and in the gang world since the collapse of the Soviet Union. You mentioned that some of the earliest, highest gang members, the first generation of gang leaders, produced some of the richest people in Russia, you say, at one point. But some of the younger people you interviewed for this book pointed out that those opportunities perhaps don't exist to the same extent anymore. Does that mean that as Russian society becomes, businesses become legitimate, the rule of law is greater, that this is a social structure that's on the way out?
I think the time of spectacular careers that could be made in the 1990s, where a person could move from street racket into ownership of large companies, they have gone. I think the not just for street lads, but for everybody else, this sort of situation of rapid mobility to be achieved both by illegal and legal means is over. The social structure has sort of stabilized, crystallized, and positions are now passed on within the family very often. So this time has gone. So these street gangs, they still exist, but their members mainly operate on the level of street economy or increasingly illegal drug trade or street level.
Which was proscribed among many street gangs, that you couldn't use drugs or deal in drugs. But
yes,
you say this could really change things.
It is changing. It is changing, and there is evidence that even gang members now can actually deal in drugs themselves and take them. So things are changing, and with it, this sort of social organization, which is quite solidaristic, is also changing. Because when a gang becomes an agent in drug distribution, the whole system of relationships change.
Maybe in conclusion, we could talk just a little bit about your perspective on the Russian higher education system. Obviously, enormous strengths in the Soviet era, in the sciences, enormous advances. Currently, there is a big drive by the Russian government to get a number of universities into world university rankings, you know, one of which is ours. Senses perhaps that the brain drain of mathematicians that we've recently written about, I think most of the Fields medalists are abroad. Do you get the sense from those you deal with that maybe the tide is turning, that the universities are regaining the ground they had in Soviet times in terms of strengths in research and so on?
There is this aspiration. And the government is funding the best universities so that they can become world-known centers for research excellence and teaching, excellence and teaching. Now, things are becoming quite difficult because of the current economic crisis. So universities are now struggling to keep the money, and there are actually quite savage cuts in all kinds of places, including now these centers of excellence. as well. So the situation currently is, it is quite difficult, but at least, you know, there is now this this goal of competing on the world stage. I think it is good, and you know, hopefully more funding will go into universities, and we have some really wonderful places, you know, in particularly in sciences, you know, mathematics, as you say, but also in social sciences as well. So I'm not totally pessimistic.
What about in a country which, to those of us in the West, we assume that while it's better than in Soviet times, it could still be problematic to be highly critical of the government. Do you think there are risks for academics in Russia who are doing work that's politically sensitive or giving a social narrative that is not positive?
Well, I think, well, from what I read and hear from colleagues, in many places there is a kind of growth of academic nationalism. So people are starting to look with some suspicion at foreign academics, right, and also feel a bit wary about communication because of the law on foreign agents, which is a law which says that if you take money from foreign organizations and you use it to fund perhaps research or activities which are political, then you need to declare yourself as a foreign agent, and the definition of political is extremely wide.
Right.
So there is this kind of sense of apprehension sometimes. There are places where people still try to maintain contact and be open. And in fact, the strange situation is that their own work is then assessed on the number of publications, and, you know, publications in foreign journals are encouraged. But in order to do this, then you have to have contacts and be a member of the international community. So I think Russian universities now find themselves in this kind of strange double bind situation, and I don't know which way things would develop. I hope that they would develop in the direction of more openness.
Thank you very much for joining us, Svetlana Stevenson, reader in sociology at London Metropolitan University. And I must encourage you to read Gangs of Russia, From the Streets to the Corridors of Power. It's a fascinating book and an amazing piece of research. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.